Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingenstein. Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingenstein with SEMA Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. Our goal is to help you become a better leader. This week, we're happy to revisit a conversation that we had some time ago with Dr. Mark Schreim. Mark is currently the International Chief Medical Officer for Mercy Ships. He was the O'Brien Chair of Global Surgery at the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland. He's a lecturer at the Global Health and Social Medicine at Harvard Medical School. He wrote a book entitled Solving for Why, A Surgeon's Journey to Discover the Transformative Power of Purpose. And a very interesting interview with Mark and just some of the things that he's learned in his career. Looking forward to today's conversation with Mark. Great to have Mark joining us today, and definitely appreciate you taking time to talk to us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Mark, I saw an interview that you gave. It was a national interview a while back, and you have a really interesting story, a personal story, and you've written a new book. But could you give us just a quick snapshot of your career, and then we're going to kind of go a little bit more in depth in your story as we talk today.
Sure, absolutely. So I am a surgeon by training. I do cancer surgery of the head and neck region. And since 2008, I've been working in global health and surgery, primarily in sub-Saharan Africa. I'm currently the chair of global surgery at the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland. And I've got an appointment in the Department of Global Health also at Harvard Medical School.
Well, and I like to ask this question, and we'll probably get more into the answer to this as we go through the topic. But if you were able to spend back time to the age of 22, knowing what you know now, what advice would you give yourself at 22?
You know, that is a hard question to answer. In that what I'm doing right now is nowhere close to what I thought I'd be doing at the age of 22, you know, but at the age of 22, I'd be doing at the age of 47. So there's this, you know, question sometimes, would you do it all over again? And I don't know how to answer that question because I wouldn't be where I am had I not gone through some of the stuff that we'll be talking about. I wouldn't be where I am had I not gone through some of that stuff.
Right.
At the same time, what would I tell myself at 22? That I think two pieces of advice I tell myself is that there is no one career path. So don't feel like you have to be wedded to the career path that, you know, you think you're on when you're starting. And I'd also relatedly say, beware, as I'm about to give advice, be wary of advice. People give advice from their own careers, which is useful, but may not necessarily be the direction that your career should be going.
So you wrote a book that came out, is entitled Solving for Why, Lessons from the Field on Life, Work, and Transformative Power of Purpose. It's a great book, and I've not read all of it yet, but I've started it, and you've got some great personal stories. And can you kind of, you know, we talked about there's kind of three chapters that were kind of breaking down your kind of your life story and lessons learned that encourage people to pick up the book to get kind of more in depth. But love to have you kind of start out with kind of a thing that really made an impact on your life, that first chapter that gave you maybe pause to think about life and purpose.
Sure. So I'll start by saying, you know, I'm a doctor, but I grew up never wanting to be a doctor. I wanted to be a linguist. I wanted to be a rock star. I wanted to be a philosopher. I wanted to be all sorts of things besides medicine. But I'm the firstborn son of an immigrant family. And as the firstborn son of an immigrant family, I really grew up with three options: doctor, lawyer, or failure. So I liked science. I liked biology. I was decent at it. And so I went to college and majored in biology. And knew that I didn't want to go into the lab. And in fact, 95% of the people graduating, this back in the 90s, 95% of people graduating from my biology program went on to med school. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really have any other plan. So I went into med school because that was just the thing that was peer pressure. I went into med school because that's what you did. And that's what the family kind of wanted. And I will be frank, I absolutely hated it. I hated every second of medical school. I was in my dean of students' office probably once a month trying to convince her to convince me that I could quit. She never did, God bless her. And she always said, and this is true, she always said, you know, hold on, not a lot of people don't like med school, just stick it out because it does get better. And look, she was right. Like, it did get better. Med school is tough. Residency is tough. Being a practicing physician is a lot easier than being a resident physician. So it did get better, but it never really kind of stuck. Even though it objectively got better, I never really liked it. But I continued on this path towards what I was saying before, this, you know, there is no one career path. I was on the sort of medicine career path. I was on the medicine conveyor belt, the moving sidewalk of medicine. And it's a lot harder to get off the moving sidewalk. So because I was on it, I decided that after medical school, I'd go to residency. I had to decide what specialty I was going to go into. And I had a real hard time deciding what specialty I was going to go into, which is common among medical students. But most of us can't pick a specialty because we like all of medicine. Medicine's very interesting. I couldn't pick a specialty because I didn't like anything in medicine. So I made the brilliant, brilliant decision that I was going to pick a specialty that would allow me to work as little as possible and make as much money as possible so that I could do everything else in my life that I wanted to do. I could play music. I could read linguistics textbooks. I could do these things that I really wanted to do. And so I picked a specialty. I picked ear, nose, and throat, which is a very good specialty. But, you know, it's that rubric for choosing a specialty is not the wisest way to pick what you're going to do for the rest of your life. Because I got into ENT and really kind of didn't like that either. Also wanted to quit. Also just miserable time in residency. Also was told the entire time in residency that it gets better. And so I stuck it out. I'll cut the story short. I stuck it out. I finished residency. I went to do a fellowship because really at that point, I had nothing else to do. I had no other marketable skills at this point. I'm whatever it is, 7 years out of college. I'm deep into the medicine moving sidewalk. And I was kind of too scared to try anything else. So I went on, did fellowship. And it was after my fellowship, which is where I learned to do the cancer surgeries. It was after my fellowship that I finally took a year off and spent 6 months of that year just traveling. And then spent 6 months of the year working in Liberia, in Monrovia, on a hospital ship. Mm. And it was on that ship, the first time I walked onto that ship, first time I walked down onto the hospital deck itself where all the patients were, and I turned into the head and neck tumor ward. And finally, this is now 15 years after I graduated from high school, finally had this road to Damascus moment. I saw that a dozen head and neck tumor patients who wouldn't have surgery otherwise. And I was like, oh, this is what I've been training for 15 years to do. And I didn't even know it.
Wow. So mercy ships that you started working on during that time, you've continued to, and we'll talk a little bit more about that and kind of just some of the experiences that you've had with that. But during that kind of that period of time, was it the accident that you had and as you were traveling, was that yes. a part of that time that that you had kind of that life and death situation
Absolutely.
Moment?
It was. And it was not long after that epiphany at that road to Damascus moment that this is the story that opens the book. So, you know, spoiler alert, but so not long after that Road to Damascus moment, you know, I was living in Liberia for just under 6 months. And at some point in there, a group of us, about 20 of us, decided to take a weekend away from the hospital ship that we were working on, and kind of get out of Monrovia, get out of the city, go up to Robertsport, which is a beach town on the sort of the northwest coast of Liberia, just at the Sierra Leonean border. And so we rented some taxis, hired some taxis, which, you know, this is 2008. Liberia was in two back-to-back civil wars that ended in 2004. So still, you know, had not rebuilt very much yet at that point. So taxis, but not taxis the way we would consider them taxis. I like to say they looked a little bit like a Flintstones cartoon, because they didn't have floorboards. Like, they had, you could see the road underneath your feet as you were in these taxis. So anyway, we start driving. And the road from Monrovia to Robertsport takes about 3 hours. The first hour you go north on this paved road, and then you take a left-hand turn, you go west on this unpaved red dirt road that was, you know, fairly flat, but it was punctuated with these rickety wooden bridges that spanned shallow ravines. So we get onto this path, and the five taxis that we were in basically get into a race with each other to see who can go fastest. And our car, the car that I was in, ended up being the fastest. So what the driver would do is, on the straight and the flat parts of the road, he would go as fast as he could until he got to a bridge. Mm-hmm. He'd take the bridge slowly, carefully, and then he'd book it again to the next bridge. Well, he stopped at one of the bridges to take it slowly and carefully. The car behind us didn't see that happen and smacked right into us and knocked us off the bridge and into the ravine. And it was in the middle of that, as literally time was slowing down, as I like was watching the ground come towards the windshield, I had this thought of, well, I guess this is how I die, and I'm okay with that. And I really think in the what has it been now, 14 years since then, I think I was okay with that, because I had finally kind of figured out the heck I was doing with my life.
So you were, you're talking about that during this process. And I think in the book you talk about, I don't know if you use the exact phrase, but that you, realized that you needed to fall in love with failure. And to take a look, but talk a little bit about that thought as you were, you kind of found out what your purpose was. But, you know, a lot of times people early on in their careers, and again, you know, some of our listeners are first time leaders and just trying to figure it out. And so many times people get just paralyzed because they're afraid of that failure
piece of
it. But talk a little bit about that and just lessons learned around that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, failure is a hard topic to talk about, because there's no getting around the fact that failure sucks. Like, failure is failure. It's, you know, there's a lot of, oh, well, you know, grit your teeth through failure, meditate your way through failure, just realize that failure is part of the path. And that's all true. Like, I'm not disparaging that. It's all true. Failure is part of the path, but failure does hurt. And I think we do ourselves a disservice when we kind of become too positive around failure. Now that I've said that, though, with that in mind, I actually think we need to go even further than just enduring failure or getting through failure or kind of intellectually recognizing that failure is a part of the process. I actually think that, my book is called Solving for Why. And I use that phrase, sort of figuring out, solving for your own why. I think it comes in a couple of steps. Some of it is epiphany moments. Some of it is Road to Damascus moments, is realizing, oh my God, this is what I want to do.
Right.
But then you've got to actually do something about it. You can't just have the epiphany moment. You've got to do something about it. And it's when you start doing something that you throw yourself up against failure. You can have an epiphany moment and do nothing about it, and you're not going to fail at doing that. So once you start stepping off that moving sidewalk, you're stepping into risky territory. And the reason that I think we need to go beyond just acknowledging failure and falling in love with it is because failure is more than just a speed bump. Failure is more than just kind of a setback. Failure is, it does a couple things for us. One, it's a signal for us. It's a signal of progress on the path that we're good at, on the moving sidewalk that we're on, moving sidewalk that I was on. One of the reasons that it's so easy to stay on that moving sidewalk is because we're good at it.
Right.
You know, we know how to meet its demands. So the minute we start hitting up against failure, well, that's a signal to us that we're actually starting to move away from that. We're actually starting to move to have some movement toward our why. The other thing that I think failure does for us, and the reason that I think we should actually court it and woo it, is there's this quote from Thomas Merton. It says, "Do not depend on the hope of results. You may have to face the fact that your work will be apparently worthless or even achieve results opposite to what you expect. As you get used to this idea, you start more and more to concentrate not on the results, but on the value, the rightness, and the truth of the work itself." And we are, especially in American culture, in medicine, in leadership culture, we're just indoctrinated into the hope of results.
Sure.
That's what we hope in, is results. And what failure does, failure is by definition the absence of results. What failure does for us is it starts to break this idolatry of the hope of results and let us start concentrating on the value, the rightness, and the truth of the work itself.
That's a great quote. Definitely something for, I think you're right. This, the culture that we have is getting the results, and that's the only thing that you're looking for. And there's always chasing those results without thinking about kind of the journey in the process. Talk about, you know, I think the maybe this is a good point, the fear of failure. You did something that's a little unusual with your training, your background. You became an American Ninja Warrior. You were on what, four seasons?
Three seasons.
Yeah. Talk a little bit of how you got involved with that, and again, you know, I think around failure, trying something new and different and challenging is definitely that qualifies.
Yeah. I got involved in Ninja Warrior in one of those incredibly wise decisions that happens in our lives at 2 a.m. I'd been staying up watching YouTube videos of Ninja Warrior. I'd been a climber. I'd been a rock climber for, at that point, probably about 5 or 6 years.
Okay.
And I was watching these Ninja Warrior videos. And at 2 a.m, I was like, "Ah, that doesn't look so hard. I could do that." So I applied. Total hubris, absolute hubris. I applied, and you know, the application is it's an 8-page application, and you've got to send in a video of yourself.
Okay, sure.
At that point, they were getting something like 75,000 applications. So I like applied and forgot about it. They're not going to take a nerdy 41-year-old doctor from Boston. But they did. They called me back. They invited me to compete on the show. They invited me to compete on the show 3 weeks before the show was actually supposed to film. So 3 weeks before I'm supposed to be on national television, I went to find a ninja gym in the Boston area. And it turns out that those obstacles are not easy because I couldn't do a single thing in that gym. At that point, an obsession was born. Like, I fell in love with this sport because it does a lot of things. I mean, first of all, it's just fun. You're a kid on the playground again. But then the second thing is it forces you to face the idea of failure and puts you, and this is the thing that I will be forever grateful for this sport, puts you among a community of people who are doing the same thing. Mm. It's so much easier to take big risks when you know that everybody else around you is also doing it. Because there is nothing in my mind, nothing scarier than standing 14 feet above the ground and jumping for an obstacle that you might just miss. And looking at that, saying, "This is a stupid idea," and then doing it anyway. Mm-hmm. And it's that move from "this is a stupid idea" but I'm going to do it anyway. That's one thing that Ninja taught me more than anything else ever has.
Yeah. And I've watched some of your videos. You look at it on TV and think, oh, I could do that, but most of us can't.
Nope.
So yeah. Talk about just the, I think you mentioned just some of the lessons around decision-making that you learned from, I think it was Gary Parker, who was the person that's in charge of surgery for Mercy Ships. Has been there, what, over 30 years?
Over 35 years, I think, at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But talk a little bit about that model. You go more in depth in the book, and definitely encourage people pick it up. But what were, just if you can give us just a quick overview of kind of that decision-making process.
Sure. Yeah, it's a great model. So this model came out of a conversation with Gary. Gary is the chief medical officer of one of the ships for Mercy Ships. And as you said, has been working as a surgeon in sub-Saharan Africa for 35 years. And we were speaking after a long day in the operating room. We were just catching up and talking about everything, life, relationships, politics, whatever. And I asked him a question about how he made big decisions in his life. And he said that when he faces a big decision in his life, he looks forward 30 years into the future at the best possible outcome of each of his options. Mm. And if one of the best possible outcomes makes him think, then he knows that that's not the right choice for him, because then he's going to spend 30 years of his life chasing something that makes him think, it's a risky decision-making paradigm. And it's not the decision-making paradigm that most of us fall into. Most of us fall into, myself included, fall into this paradigm that looks 30 years down the line at the worst possible outcome. And we try to cushion that fall as much as we can, so that even if we hit the worst possible outcome, it's not as bad as it could be. So we pick the best of the worst. Gary picks the best of the best. And I think when he told me that, I have now applied that to my own career. That was what made me come back from Africa, look at my career as a clinician, as a head and neck surgeon, working at a hospital in the US for the next 30 years. And we look at that career path and realize that over that career path, I would have treated, a few thousand patients. Some of them would have lived, some of them would have died, because I'm a cancer surgeon, so not everyone makes it. And then I'd retire after 30 years with, a decent retirement package, and that would be it. And for me, and your own purpose is your own purpose, but for me, I looked down that road and thought, that doesn't do it for me. And that was what made me really decide that I needed to get off that moving sidewalk.
So you go and you operate on people, and I've seen some of the pictures of people that you've operated on, and I was just actually with my girls this weekend, and I was showing pictures of before and after, and some of it it's mind-boggling, because you just I've never seen anything like that. These growths that are enormous, that I think I've heard you say that, in the US you get a little lump on your neck and you go to the doctor and get it taken care of. But, some of these people have had some of these things going on for 20 plus years.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, it's just amazing. But talk a little bit about just, that work. And I know you bring students along with you as far as when you're doing that, but give us just one of your best stories about somebody that you treated and just the results of it.
Yeah, sure. Look, I think the story I turn to most often is again from way back in 2008 when I was in Liberia. Right after having this epiphany moment, probably before the car crash that we talked about. I'd met this patient who was 22 at the time, and he had had a tumor of his jaw, tumor of the bone of his jaw, that had expanded that bone over the course of 8 years. So since he was 14, and it expanded it so much that, it was massive. In the end, it was six pounds. So it was this huge football shaped thing growing off of his jaw that grew outward, but also grew inward. meaning that it became more and more difficult for him to breathe, more and more difficult for him to navigate food around the tumor to get it back into, you know, so he could actually swallow it. So by the time we saw him, his blood count was, you know, it was one of those things that you tell everyone about. You know, his blood count was so low that it shouldn't be compatible with life, but he had just been living with it for so long that his body had gotten used to having, to being that anemic. So he came to us. I operated with Gary Parker on this case. We took out the tumor, and in doing so, took out the majority of his jaw, left a little bit of bone on one side to which we could attach a metal plate to be kind of a placeholder for 3 months. And then 3 months afterwards, brought him back into the operating room, borrowed some bone from his hip to create a new jaw where that plate was. Wow. And it's really hard to describe in a, you know, in an audio format, in a podcast. I wish, sure, I could show pictures of the man's smile afterwards. Because he was, it's super cheesy to say it this way, but he was a new person. After that, he had a new jaw, he had a new smile. It's just amazing to see. And that, combine that with the epiphany moment, combine that with the, you know, this was just further for myself, further confirmation that this is really what I want to be doing.
Yeah, that's really cool. I encourage people to look up just some of the pictures online. You can definitely find those and pretty amazing. And I'm sure that it's got to be so rewarding to see somebody's life completely turned around and changed. I wanted to ask this question. You do, you know, 10 months of work where you're focused on doing your job, and then 2 months where you're doing some really hard work, but it's more kind of around your purpose and I think your whole life is built around purpose. But how do you get, you know, 12 months of work done in 10 months, and how do you negotiate that with your employer?
So I'm really lucky in that all of my life at this point, and it took a while to get here, but all of my career is now focused around the delivery of surgery in low-income countries. I get to personally do the delivery itself for, you know, 12 weeks or so, 10 to 12 weeks out of a year. So I get to be the one at the coalface holding the knife. But the other 10 months are still, you know, my research, my teaching, my advocacy is all around the delivery of surgery. So I'm really lucky in that I've been, you know, privileged to be able to structure my entire career around this why. But it's non-traditional. It is non-traditional to say to an employer, you know, I'm going to leave for a few weeks, a year. And I tell people who are coming out of their training, and especially when you're negotiating your first job, that you need to go into that job. You know, you're going into your first job, you're essentially going into a negotiation with not a ton of power, not a ton of negotiating power. And you need to recognize that, unfortunately. It's not a great place, sure, to be, but you need to recognize that you've got not a ton of negotiating power. So in your mind, have three things that are non-negotiables for you. And stick to those. And then be willing to negotiate on everything else. And for me, taking time off to go be on the ship in Africa was a non-negotiable. Salary, on the other hand, was not a non-negotiable for me. So that's where the give ended up happening, is that the first hospital I worked for in the end said, yes, we'll let you do this, but we're not going to pay you when you're working at, you know, in Benin. And that was fine. So that was one of my non-negotiables, and I was able to negotiate it into a contract, but ended up having to sort of give on other things.
So are there other books that you would recommend that have had impact on you and your life and around purpose anything that you would recommend to other leaders?
Yeah, I think, you know, I was thinking about this question because you forewarned me that you would ask this question. And it's a good question. I think, well, one thing I'm going to say is I have not met a good leader who doesn't read. Mm-hmm. A colleague of mine who went into sort of leadership positions a couple of years before I did actually told me, he's like, he blocks off in his calendar the first couple of hours of the day to do what he calls deep work, or it's reading, it's journaling, it's this sort of stuff. He doesn't put meetings in that time of day. He tries not to respond to emails, and he puts it on his public calendar, so his staff know that too. And I've taken that on as well. I block off time to do reading because, heck, you know, people have invented these wheels before us. There's no reason for us to reinvent them. When it comes to leadership books in general, there are two that I've read a couple times and would really recommend, and then one that I've just started reading that I'm going to recommend even though I haven't finished it. The two that I really, really like, one is called The Advice Trap. And it's by Michael Bungay Stanger. And basically the thesis of his book is we're too quick to give advice. Somebody comes to us for advice, so we feel like, well, they want to know what I have to say. But his thesis is that it's unlikely that you've even understood the question by the time you're opening your mouth to give advice. And I experienced this in my own career. You know, what I needed from my mentors wasn't advice on how to survive residency. Mm-hmm. It was advice on, hey, think about your career in a different way. I didn't even know the question I was asking, and they for sure hadn't understood the question by the time they were giving advice. So The Advice Trap. The second one by Dan Coyle is called The Culture Code. I think probably my top leadership book that I've ever read. There's the saying, culture eats strategy for breakfast. And I found that to be true over and over and over again. And what Coyle does in this book is, instead of viewing culture as this amorphous thing that does or doesn't happen in places, he actually talks about how you create it. What are the little things that you as a leader can do to start creating feelings of belonging, to start creating value, to start, you know, creating the culture that actually leads to better results. It's made me think a lot about even little things like, how do I address my emails? You know, how do I open my emails? How do I sign my emails? Small things like that. They feel weird and sometimes forced, but I've actually seen them work. The one that I am in the middle of reading, but that I'm finding really, really impactful, is called Leadership Without Authority. And I think especially in this post-pandemic era, when we're going to be kind of back in the offices, maybe not, kind of hybrid, maybe not, how do you lead when you're talking to 16 boxes on a screen? How do you, as Gary Parker, that I've mentioned before, likes to say, how do you sit around a mango tree and come to a decision? Because, you know, as you know, you never get to 100% consensus on any decision, but you need to get to 80% consensus. You know, if you're at 40% and you make a decision, people will go ahead and go along with it, but will subtly undermine you along the way. And so this book really talks about how do you lead without kind of imposing authority.
Great recommendations. And some of those we haven't heard. We actually had Michael Bungay Stanger just on our podcast. Awesome. I watched his video on the advice monster. And So I told him, I said, my wife wanted me to watch that one because I like to provide advice. So anyway, what do you do to recharge? And I think you've got, do you still do some of at least the exercise? I know you're probably not competing. Are you competing anymore as far as in?
So I've just spent a whole, couple of minutes talking about how you need to fall in love with failure and take all sorts of risks and all that sort of stuff. Well, I was doing that a year ago and basically destroyed my knee on a really bad fall. So I'm still in rehab for it. It's an 18-month rehab process. But you know, my goal is to get back to ninja, get back to climbing. That's how I de-stress, honestly. Okay. Yeah.
Great. Well, how would somebody learn more about your book and your work? And also definitely want to put a plug in for Mercy Ships.
Yeah. So my book is available at basically anywhere books are sold. So Amazon, Barnes & Noble, your local bookstore, the library. It's called Solving for Why. And I'd love, you know, for people to read it, and I'd love to hear what people think about it. You can also find a link to buying it on my own webpage, which is markshrine.com. And then Mercy Ships is www.mercyships.org. You can find more information about Mercy Ships. You can also find ways to volunteer or to be a part of Mercy Ships.
Great. Well, I wish you continued success in all you're doing. Your plate is very full, but it sounds like you figured out how to do all this, and definitely wish you continued success.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.